From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. India has been a great big jewel in the crown of the story of the meteoric rise of economic heavyweights from the bubbling developing world. Asian tiger, shining star, sizzling new India. But lately, that story has taken a hit in India. Growth is down, things are gloomy, and the narrative has turned to corruption, still huge poverty, inequality, and bad news for women. This hour on Point, the big stumble and rethink in India. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is it strange to hear of a stumble in this class of countries after all the years of upward roar? What's the lesson in the story here from India? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Delhi in India is Adam Roberts, South Asia Bureau Chief for The Economist. Adam Roberts, thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
What are the economic metrics that we might look at first on India's stumble?
Well, if you want to begin with the economy, you have to remember that it was only 2 or 3 years ago that the economy of India was being compared with that in China. It was near double-digit growth. There was talk about India becoming an economic superpower. Growth of 8, 9, 10% would lift millions and millions of people out of poverty. And yet what we have today is an economy that, yes, has stumbled, where the rupee is wobbling around and falling very fast, where growth has fallen to below 6%, down to about 5% and even lower, and jobs are not being created, the mood is down, investors are worried, and by and large, the fizz has gone out of the economy.
Why the stumble, Adam?
Well, different reasons. Partly, it was supported for the last 2 or 3 years by the American economy, by the pumping out of lots of quantitative easing from the American economy that benefited places like India. And as that tide has turned, confidence in India has gone as well. But I'd say there are much bigger reasons, homegrown reasons, the lack of economic reform in India for the past 4 or 5 years that has really upset investors, and I mean domestic Indian investors, who are preferring to invest elsewhere, not in India, but preferring to go to Europe, to the Middle East, to Africa, to other places, rather than investing at home. And if you travel here, like I do all the time, you can just see the stumbling blocks, the broken roads, the crowded ports, the overwhelmed railway system. The infrastructure of India just isn't up to the job.
So is this seen as temporary or built on deep issues? Is this a stumble or India hitting a wall, Adam?
I think it's been brewing for a while. I mean, we were warning in The Economist over a year and a half ago that there were problems coming and that there was a big, nasty shock that was going to hit India and hit its economy. But it's really happened and it's really become obvious in the last 3 or 4 months. We would still be warning that the fundamental problems haven't been fixed. There are more reforms of the economy that need to be done that haven't happened. But in the long run, there's a lot of reasons to be hopeful about India. It's a huge population, young population, lots of things that can be improved. So even the most gloomy people don't say, forget about India. They're just saying India could do a lot more, a lot faster, to get back to the sort of growth it was seeing 3 or 4 years ago.
These may be one and the same, but do the stumbling blocks appear to be economic or cultural? Those are hard to tease apart sometimes, I know.
Yeah, I'd say there's another possibility. It's political. It's politicians who took their eye off the ball, who didn't dare do difficult, unpopular things when their going was good, and now are being forced to do them in a sense of panic instead. And so when there's lots of money rolling around and lots of money to be spent, you could have spent it on good infrastructure. You could have spent it on getting a more productive economy, getting people into education, or opening up your economy to be more competitive. Instead, the politicians, like politicians everywhere, tended to go for the easy route. They'd rather spend the money on more handouts for people or boondoggles or updating the latest airport or something, but they didn't make the difficult decisions. So I would say political, more political than cultural.
Quick sizzle versus maybe a deep investment. And here's a question for you. You're magazine or newspaper, as you like to call it, The Economist, has written about the era of disruptive ascendance of the BRIC, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, these big rising developing world economic powers, the era of their ascendance being over. Do you see a wider story in India's stumble across all of those, or is this India's alone, this story of stumble?
Well, the thing I mentioned at the beginning, the fact that that easy money that was being pumped out from especially the American Central Bank now being pulled back into America, that's hitting every emerging economy. That's hitting Indonesia, South Africa, all of them. So it's not just India that's worried right now. But also the other thing that we're hoping that India was banking on, this huge population that was going to be so well educated, it could set up call centers to compete with the West, and it could do all the outsourcing and so on. Well, all that's all good and well, but unless you're also doing factories that will produce clothing and doing the more basic stuff, the manufacturing, the kind of workshop of the world stuff, you haven't got a balanced economy. And India's particular problem is it doesn't create jobs. It doesn't take those people coming off the farmers' fields and put them into more productive urban work. India's terrible at doing that. It's great at the high-end stuff, the really well-educated, the brilliant technicians, the engineers, and so on. But it's not very good at what China does, getting millions, tens upon millions of people into factories and working much more productively than they used to. So I think India especially has some really tough challenges ahead.
A big stumble in the story of India's bright and shining rise. Many faces to that story. Adam Roberts is South Asia Bureau Chief for The Economist, joining us from Delhi. Adam, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Here is Indian journalist and media personality Pranoy Roy on New Delhi Television last month, commenting on the state of his country's economy now.
Things are really, really bad. If we carry on like this, India will be declared junk status. This junk status rating could even happen, some say, in less than a year from now. There is even a possibility that India will have to go back to the IMF.
Gloomy talk out of India, and a lot of talk about corruption. Anna Hazara has made a lot of noise about this, big social activist there. Here's one of his deputies, Arvind Kejriwal, talking about India's corruption problem.
Corruption is now a huge problem in our country, right from the common man who faces demands of bribery on a day-to-day basis in government departments to the top, where ministers and bureaucrats indulge in corruption.
And the country knows it, but what to do about it? What to do about the stumble? Anand Giridharadas joins us now from New York, author of India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. He writes the Admit One in Currents columns for the New York Times. Anand, welcome back to On Point. Very good to have you here.
Great to be back with you.
So you know India well, you know this country well. I want to stipulate right off the bat, people are talking about economic problems and schools that need attention and inequities and inequality. I mean, we have plenty of numbers out of this country on inequality that do not look so great, on infrastructure investment that do not look so great. But here they are in a country where, I mean, and frankly, if you look at the just strict measures, India is not as unequal as the United States. But in India, a lot of that is about poverty. There's just so much poverty that inequality is dragged down into that. What do you think is going on in this big stumble, Anand? We were all enthralled with India's stellar rise.
I think, first of all, I think it's important to separate what has clearly turned a corner and changed since even 5 years ago and what hasn't. So I think a lot of the people you've featured already are making very valid points about an economic fizzling, limits to governance, enduring corruption problems, enduring poverty problems. And certainly the pace of growth has slowed and the pace of economic and structural change has slowed. But I think what a lot of these analyses, which are heavily infused by economic thinking, mm-hmm. which we should remember is only one kind of thinking,
of course,
are limited in their view of the larger story of India, which is, I think, a story about individuals who have been historically reined in by economics, but also by caste and class and family and tradition and all kinds of things which restrained and repressed individual potential. Over the last several decades, and particularly in more recent decades, that has started to break. And you've started to release individual potential. A big part of that has been economic growth. But it's really important to remember that a lot of that happens, that kind of emancipation, that people feeling a freedom to marry who they want, take a job in another town, start a business even though their parents don't think it's a good idea. That stuff is happening and it continues on. And emancipation and growth are different. And I think if you look at the history of the West, an emancipation story was a much more consistent story over the last 500 years than whether growth was at 3% one year or 8% one year.
So are you saying that India has harvested like first fruit of unleashing a lot of individual talent and ambition here, but what is now running up against deeper issues that individuals can't solve?
That's exactly right. And I think if you think about the period between independence and 1991, when the market was liberalized, mm-hmm. the big focus was building public systems, public infrastructure, big public companies.
Before.
It did
yep.
a lot to mm-hmm. to weave a country together, generate buy-in of millions of people to a new republic. It was hugely inefficient, and pressures grew in 1991, finally realized to liberalize and open up. That has unleashed Phase two, let's say, which is really unshackling individuals. Great companies have been founded. You know, millions of people have come out of poverty and pursued their kind of individual destinies. I think we are reaching the kind of decadence of phase two and entering phase three, which is going to be about great institution building so that these individual ambitions can actually come together and be more than the sum of their parts.
It is a very tough changing of gears, maybe, in India right now. NPR's Delhi Bureau Chief Julie McCarthy says Indians are very unhappy campers these days. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about India in trouble. Its once surging economy stalling, corruption and poverty unaddressed, and new questions emerging about the big story of the shiny, inevitable rise of a great developing nation here. Kannan Giridharadas joins us from New York today. He spent a lot of time thinking and writing about and living in India, and it's great to have him with us. Anand, of course, Amartya Sen, Nobel Prize winner, and his co-author Jean Dries writing in An Uncertain Glory, a big new book from them, about what in review Jyoti Tatum called a preening consumer economy built on the backs of the destitute, kind of destined not to really take everybody all the way or even stay high, stay preening and up. What about this issue of inequality and poverty? Has the economic rise addressed it at all?
You know, it has to some extent. You're dealing with such a big country that there's certainly millions of people who have come out of poverty, but there are, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 people who haven't for every person who has. And I think to take a kind of cultural lens instead of a purely economic mm-hmm. one, part of the problem is the growth stuff and the failure to open up certain sectors or to regulate certain things better, all that kind of things. But there's also a problem of, I don't know that you've had a social revolution in India in which the average Indian feels that each is their brother's keeper. And people still, it's a very hierarchical society. And people get, you know, in the new urban professional kind of upper middle class, people get very exercised about corruption. But corruption is basically, you know, exercising them because it's the misspending of their tax money. I'm not sure that you have a real galvanized anger about the number of babies who die before age one or the number of girls who are, you know, killed as soon as they're born or about the rampant diseases that are kind of dumb diseases that have been solved almost everywhere else but persist in India. I think you need a broader wave of anger that actually looks at how do we spread the good life to lots of people and get away from, in some ways, a narrative fed by Western investors, which is growth rate, growth rate, growth rate. Growth rate does
without
not necessarily...
Without concern for who's pocketing all that growth lucre.
And we in America right now know something about
yes,
it.
Yes, we
because,
do. We sure do.
Because the stock market's not doing that badly, but people are.
Amartya Sen writes about the largest population of seriously undernourished people in the world. You say the brother's keeper idea has not really taken root. We can see all around the world where it may be, you know, mouthed and talked about, but where it's very often not acted on. Of course, some countries much better than others. I mean, you spent a lot of time in the United States, spent a lot of time in India. Is the brother's keeper idea that much so much healthier or different here than there?
I think it is, it's uncomfortable to say that. But I think the reality is the West just grew very differently and in some ways had its social revolutions before it got its investment banks and fancy malls. And India in some ways is backing into this stuff. It's getting the hard stuff first and the easy stuff later. So India has women in parliament, but it's not safe for women to walk on the street in Delhi. And India has complex derivatives trading at the highest order, but it's pretty tough to open a little shop on your corner. So it's solving the hard problems before it solves the easy ones for regular people. And I think with regard to the brother's keeper aspect of it, there was a real change in going back to the Renaissance in the West about people having a new idea of equality and dignity. And it took a very long time to extend that to women and to, you know, former slaves and to all kinds of other people. But the history has been, and, you know, going back to the Declaration of Independence here, all men are created equal. And that's it's an imperfectly realized ideal, but it is the ideal. And I think if you have real conversations with people in India, I don't think that people are convinced of that idea in their gut. And I'm not sure how great a society you can build if people do not in their deepest gut believe that everybody else has the same potential as them if given a chance.
It's a rough foundation for democracy. I mean, those ideals at least were here in the United States, often unobserved, but that is, as you say, sort of baked into a lot of hard-won Western philosophy. How's it work in a democracy if that's not there? Or, hey, Americans worry about it slipping away. But what about not having that down at bottom in a democracy?
Sudhir Kakkar is one of my favorite writers on India as a psychoanalyst who kind of uses his years of psychoanalytic practice to actually kind of draw larger conclusions about how Indians think about a variety of things, has said that India is the world's largest and most plural democracy, sitting over top the most hierarchical, unequal society in the world. And there's something to that. Now, democracy is a really great system. It doesn't require necessarily people to have the best virtues in their heart when they vote. People vote. It works. There's no coups. It's a very high-functioning democracy compared to anybody in its neighborhood. But I think at some point and by the way, this happened in the West. This happened in America, which is actually why I'm not so worried about it. I think at some level there's a logic to these phases. But you can extract the value of your best 5% of people.
Yeah.
And at some point, if your maid's son is so poorly developed intellectually that he doesn't found Google and that 800 million other people like him don't found the Googles that they could found, at some point everybody starts to realize we are wasting all the things we could be doing because our best ballerinas and our best Olympians and our best company founders and our best regulators and our best lawyers are all hidden in slums that they're never getting out of, and we are not extracting the juice from our people.
5% of a billion plus is a lot of people, but you can only write it so far. We've talked about a brother's keeper. What about sister's keeper? You know, we have had all these terrible stories, a couple that really rose to international prominence about terrible, brutal rapes in India that got the world's attention, that clearly got India's attention as well. What about the issue of women and their mistreatment? Is that part of this gloomy self-examination apparently going on?
I think it is. And, you know, these things are always in some ways random, how narratives build and what events coincide with other events. And there was the anti-corruption movement and then the kind of last year and slowing growth this year and this multiple gang rapes. And I think it's all contributed to the gloom. I think on the women front, again, you have a similar issue of having built a lot of superficial progress without building any of the underpinning progress. So, you know, I remember a few years ago in India, I wrote about the advent of this very popular, you know, so-called chick lit. And there were these like great books coming out, you know, great by, you know, some definition, that were, you know, urban, sophisticated women kind of bringing the Sex and the City revolution to India. And that was great. And people get very excited about it. The newspapers write about it. You have, you know, Fashion Week and all this other stuff. But you still haven't solved the basic problem of the fact that in the average slum, a woman has to wait in line a few hours to go to the bathroom, and people often taunt and sexually harass her when she's in there by herself at night. And I think you have to come to a place of saying, what is it about the average person's view of women, not these you know, gang rapists, which it's very easy to other them and say there's like 50 bad people in India. I think the average person needs to say, what is it about my view of women, my own view of women, that allows this to be their condition in these extreme crimes, but frankly, allows it to be so commonplace for women to be groped and harassed in a train or walking down the street, that frankly allow women to be essentially seen at when you, again, get really down and real with people, as means to an end and means to the end of men instead of as ends in themselves.
A big moment of reflection in India. Anand Giridharadas is with us, author of India Calling. Big economist Arvind Subramanian joins us in just a moment. I want to get a few callers in here, if I may. First from New Orleans, Anoop is calling. Anoop, thank you. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am a 26-year-old recent master's of public health student. My parents are immigrants from India.
Okay.
And I want to make two quick points. I work, I started my own nonprofit in India doing sanitation work. And I want to make two points really quickly. First is just that I think we're putting too much emphasis on looking at just pure economic indicators as metrics of success. And I think Mr. Anand has hinted at that, and that is certainly the case in Dr. Sen's book, Development as Freedom, as well. And the two things I'll say to that is we haven't talked at all about how 650 million Indians don't actually have toilets and are forced to defecate outside, and all of the health consequences and economic consequences of that. And then tying that into Mr. Roberts' point earlier, if you liberate those people with toilets, then you do have tens of millions of people that can join the workforce because they are healthy.
Yeah.
And then about the Sister's Keeper point, I will say, if you look at India's neighbor, Bangladesh, Bangladesh on a whole is a much poorer country than India by conventional economic measures. However, their emphasis on women's rights has led Bangladesh to have much better health and education indicators than India. And I think that's proof that, you know, if you prioritize the right indicator and metric, you will have success in improving quality of life, and that will then lead to better economic indicators for the whole country.
But Anoop, how can it be prioritized right next door in Bangladesh and not in India? I mean, these are overlapping cultures in so many ways.
I think Mr. Anand talked about that as well, and that is you look at the stratification of Indian society, you look at how entrenched the caste system is, even though it has been abolished legally by the government. I mean, you have upper caste Indians who look at their lower caste compatriots as subhuman, and that is part of the reason for corruption, because to take advantage of someone lower than you, it's okay, and that is embedded in the Indian psyche, and I'm convinced that that is, once we start prioritizing, and that's the point I'm trying to make, once we start prioritizing these other factors, the economic growth will follow suit. But we're looking at it backwards right
now. Yep, Anoop, we've got it. And I'm so grateful for your call. Good luck with your work there. Caste system, an old part of Hindu culture there in India, supposedly, you know, outlawed, but everybody says no. I want to turn to all that. One more first from Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, you're on.
Thanks, Tom, for my call. I mean, what I'm going to say, you've all touched on it, and I truly believe it's a remnant from the caste system, and it's a cautionary tale for all of us, that if we don't float together, we sink alone. I worked intimately with a man from India in a photo studio in Boston, and I remember he kept circling back around to my personal history over and over and over again, trying to kind of place me. And I said, look, my people are dirt farmers, and my great-great-grandfathers fought in the Civil War.
And
I'm an artist. And he didn't want to make that connection when he found out I wasn't from a wealthy family. And I, you know, he's a nice enough guy.
But he was inclined to pigeonhole you somehow, Dave, and as if the dirt farmer with soldiers in the Civil War wouldn't have the right standing. Yeah, watch out for that everywhere. I appreciate your call. Anand, what about these two? Anoop in New Orleans, who's, you know, working in it and reminds us of the huge numbers of people kind of on the outside looking in. And Dave, with the same concern over caste system and its lingering effect, that sort of who's subhuman here?
What I loved about both of those calls is that they were both unfashionable in a way that I also often feel unfashionable, which is it's not fashionable to talk about culture these days.
Mm-hmm.
We're very comfortable saying India needs a new port and it needs a new road and it needs to open this sector or that sector. But we're not comfortable talking about, as Anoop says, a large number of people think another large number of people are subhuman. If that's the case, you're going to have all kinds of problems, including economic ones. And I think if I can kind of flip it around mm-hmm. to a kind of optimism, I think if you go back to the history, the disappointment of India for many people is that it's not China. It doesn't grow at 10%.
Forever.
But I would step back and say, this is how free countries develop. They hit walls. People get angry about the walls,
yep.
and then enough pressure builds and people tear down the wall, and then they eventually hit the next wall.
I'll go for that.
And so I think this is hitting a wall. But we hit the wall when you had the robber barons, and that gave rise to the progressive era here,
in
and
US,
to trust
yep.
busting and mm-hmm. all kind and regulation and the FDA so people didn't put antifreeze mm-hmm. in medicine. Mm-hmm. We had all the same problems. And so the optimistic way to think about this is people may be realizing the diminishing returns to individual ambition.
It's not all about economics, but economics are right there in it. This will be interesting. Arvind Subramanian joins us right now from Washington, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and at the Center for Global Development, author of Eclipse, Living in the Shadow of China's Economic Dominance, former assistant director in the research department at the IMF. Arvind Subramanian, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I want to turn with you eventually here to this economy-culture dance that Anand points out. But economically, what's the core you see of what's caused the stumble here? We'll look at culture as well, but economically, what's the heart of what's gone wrong?
Tom, before I answer that question, I think I just want to say a couple of, you know, prefatory remarks.
Sure, sure.
One is that, you know, when you talk about India, I think there's a dictum that's attributed to Joan Robinson of Cambridge when she said that, you know, everything and its opposite is true in India. You know, for every, one morning I get up feeling optimistic about India, the other morning I feel pessimistic, you know, and both are going on, and one needs to recognize that. And the other thing is that even whether we talk about economy or culture or caste, I mean, I think a lot depends upon your frame of reference. I mean, it's like, you know, the economist's wife turns the economist and says, honey, do you love me? And he says, relative to what? So is it relative to how India was doing in the past? Is it relative to the United States? So I think we need to keep that in mind. You know, take the caste question, for example. Yes, it's still there. Yes, it's very pernicious. Yes, it leads to, you know, people being deemed as subhuman. But actually, enormous strides have been made, as Anand pointed out, in the last 20 years on kind of improvements in the caste system. So you know, Devesh Kapoor at the University of Pennsylvania has some research which shows that in the last 20 years, in some parts of Uttar Pradesh, which is, you know, the biggest state in India,
yeah.
Not just economically, but the kind of social mobility and all kinds of good things that are happening, which lead to a breakdown of caste barriers, has been happening to a great extent. It's part of it is due to growth, but part of it is due to the fact that some of these castes have acquired political power and are using it to, you know, improve their lot.
Arvind Subramanian, please stand by right there. We have to take a short break. And Anand Giridharadas, of course, I mean, all true perhaps. At the same time, Amartya Sen writing in his new book, The Lack of Healthcare, Tolerably Good Schools, and Other Basic Facilities, keeps a majority of Indians shackled to their deprived lives in a way quite rarely seen in other self-respecting countries that are trying to move ahead in the world. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about India in trouble, its once surging economy stalling a bit here. Corruption and poverty unaddressed, Indians say, and new questions emerging about the big story of the shiny, inevitable rise of a great developing nation. Maybe it's just a pause. Maybe it's more to be dealt with here before things roll again. Arvind Subramanian joins us. He's at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, author of Eclipse, economist with a big view of India and the developing world. Anand Giridharadas is with us from Washington, from New York, author of India Calling, writes now for the New York Times. Lots of response online here. Let me share just a couple. Yars, a little cynical. He says, the U.S., about the U.S., we simply offshored our slavery. Okay, well, we sent a lot of work abroad, but hey, we wanted those jobs. But let me put this to both of you, and I'm not sure about the conclusion. This is a bit long, but from listener Jim, he says, India is falling hard. And don't forget Brazil. When interest rates go up, Brazil as well as Indian businesses will collapse. These companies borrow against the U.S. dollar when interest rates are extremely cheap here, but they are headed up now. He says, so watch out. And as with social issues in India, he says, it'll never change. I talk with an unbiased Indian colleague. Until the caste system goes, you'll see the issue of female infanticide, current ratio between male, female in India, unsustainable. And then says this, India has two options. Stop the caste system for real, I guess, and the dowry system around women. And number two, fight a war against China. I don't know where that comes from. But Anand, what do you make about that whole analysis?
I'm very glad that Jim has no leadership position in India, because those all sound like uniformly, the interest rate and the caste thing are illegal to some degree already, although still very much in practice. I think, just to step back, I've sounded some kind of dour notes as well as optimistic ones. I think it's easy to get irritated sometimes with all this kind of wither India anxiety, because in some ways India is growing no differently, as Arvind will tell you, looking at growth rates better than I can, growing no differently than the West did over, 100, 200-year period. And there can be a bit of a whiff of neocolonialism in this kind of the white man's burden today is to make sure that, poor brown people grow at the proper rates that we think they should grow at. The Industrial Revolution happened at, 2-3% growth. And part of what happens, I think, at lower rates of growth is the non-economic sectors of the economy, like philosophers and universities and civil society and NGOs, kind of keep pace with growth and a changing economy. And part of what happened, I lived in India from 2003 to 2009 in the kind of thick of this growth spree. Mm-hmm. The only really dynamism was in business. And no one else could keep up. The watchdogs couldn't keep up. The newspapers couldn't really keep up with any kind of quality reporting. And at some level, one of the things about slower growth, although it does, have a lot of costs, is that it allows a kind of more rounded, balanced growth of all kinds of different institutions that actually you need in a high-quality society.
Arvind Subramanian, what about it? Does a pause in that growth give India a window in which to maybe address some of these underlying problems? Do you see that happening?
I think, one of the lessons we learn from all crises, Tom, is that crises are actually very good for reforms. I think if you look at the European Union, if you look at the United States, if you look at all these troubles that all these countries that had economic troubles, once you stare at the abyss, governments actually implement a lot of good reform. And in fact, even in the last 1 year, India has, done some of the right things on, liberalizing its economy to foreign direct investment, trying to deregulate, push through investment projects, and so on. But I think one of the things we haven't spoken about, Tom, which is, I think, important when we think about, how is change going to happen in India? Change of the more fundamental sort that, Anand spoke about, the callers have spoken about, Adam Roberts spoke about. How is change going to happen? I mean, caste is illegal, de jure, but the point is that these are very slow historical processes and change very slowly. So the question is, where is change going to come from? And here is a couple of optimistic notes in India.
Good.
What is happening is that, we all think about India and reform as somehow centered in New Delhi. But actually, over the last 20, 30 years, economic political, social power are decentralizing, are moving toward the states. So states have a much greater say in determining what happens to people within their confines. And here, two things are happening.
Is that good? It can be bad,
It can be bad, but here's the positive spin on it, and I'll come to what might be mm-hmm. negative about this, is that some states in India, you know, are actually doing well, at least on the economic side, and some even on the social side. So Gujarat, for example, is a model for attracting investment, for growing, etc. Kerala is a model for, you know, mm-hmm. having very good gender relations, social indicators as well. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens when you decentralize is this, that when some states do well, there is more pressure on other states. You know, there are good demonstration effects. No longer can one state say, oh, my God, you know, this is inevitable in India when, you know, someone says, hey, the guy next door is doing very well. That's one source of pressure. And the other, of course, is that, you know, when some states do well, they attract capital, they attract people, and lo and behold, that also exerts pressure.
But
here's the final point. Mm-hmm. This competition between states dynamic is working. And what is really, I think, optimistic is that states that are doing well are actually being rewarded by being reelected. So in a sense, you know, democracy itself has to throw up the solutions. And it is to some, you know, extent, because good governance is being rewarded. And that puts pressure on, you know, other states to perform.
But I have the impression that this race to the top may not be working. Anand, you've said, you know, look, we've got individuals who've come to the fore, but overall government falling down in terms of so far in building in these changes that Indians seem to in many ways quite want. This race to the top, do you see it paying, Anand?
I think Arvind's absolutely right that there are huge variations in state outcomes, and they've been in a lot of flux the last several years. So that he's right. That's absolutely great, and it shows correlations between, you know, this policy and this outcome, and you have a bit of a laboratory, which has been part of the China story as well. I think politics is a very important part of what's going on here, but there are other things besides, like the family, for example, that also need to be changed and modernized. And that is much more complicated because you have a lot of families and they don't all take orders and they don't compete necessarily in the same way as states.
You're talking about gender relations there when you look pointed at
gender
families?
Relations, whether you let your kid, you know, encourage your kid to pursue their potential or to stick around living with you or to, and whether, you know, people are able to pursue growth opportunities in a way, but also preserve the social connectedness that mm-hmm. continues to be very important to Indians. Those are a bunch of issues as well. So if you say, if you kind of go back to a lot of the things we've talked about, how do you make an attack on caste and those kinds of things? How do you, to Arvind's point, improve policymaking at the state level? How do you reform the family? These are a huge array of things that are not necessarily all connected in the most direct way. And I think the stepping back, you really need a lot more social movement in addition to economic growth. Because a lot of these problems we're talking about, when solved elsewhere, were solved through a concert of social movements and economic change.
I want to come back to that and your note on neocolonialism, but so many callers waiting here. Bhavik in Pewaukee, Wisconsin. Bhavik, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks
Hello.
For taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I am from India, and I have spent 12 years in this country. And when I compare the politicians in this country with the politicians in India, I feel that a lot of trouble that India faces right now is primarily due to politicians putting their personal interests ahead of country's interests, whereas most of the politicians here are the other way around.
Boy, a lot of Americans might be slapping their forehead right now and thinking, are American politicians really so great? But you think so, relatively, Bhavik? What do you observe?
I think relatively that is true. That's what my observation is. And, you know, there is so much monetary policy can do if the fiscal policy is governed by people, you know, whom people do not trust at all. You know, people in India, they evade taxes primarily because they don't want to give the money to the government. They don't trust the government at all.
Yeah. Bhavik, I appreciate your call. Let us hold that for a moment and turn, if I may, to Alpine, Texas. Pam is calling. Hi, Pam. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, how do the spiritual traditions of India help solve or contribute to these problems?
All right. Let's take both here. Pam, thank you. Anand, what about Pam's question?
I think what's interesting is all these changes that we've been talking about exert, I think, two different kinds of pressure broadly, and maybe millions, but broadly two, which is one, you do have people, I think, acquiring a more this world orientation as opposed to a next world orientation, or perhaps in addition to.
To Pam's question.
There's less fatalism, more of a sense that, as a guy I wrote about in Maharashtra said, you know, the old generation believes that God gives your destiny. I believe my decisions are my destiny.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, that younger generation is a little bit sometimes lost, unmoored, confused, living far from family. And you do see in other cases a return to spirituality, sometimes in a strength that is more than the parents' spirituality. So I think it really cuts different ways. And I think you will have some religious revival movements, even as you have in some ways a secularization more broadly of people's attitude to, you know, where their success and fate comes from.
Arvind Subramanian, let me bring you to this issue of the great number of poor in India. And you and others have pointed to part of the wall that India's hit for a minute here, is, as others have pointed out, its development was not like China's. China's,
right,
you know, built these factories and churned all this stuff out. You've said India never took advantage of the huge labor pool. It took advantage of the sort of best educated at the top, put them in call centers and research and all the rest. Is there a cultural problem with unlocking the potential of that huge labor pool that's also, much of it, mired in poverty and disempowerment?
Yeah, I don't know whether it's a cultural issue or not, but you know, India has been fairly unique. If you look at all the successful development experiences over the last 25, 30, 40 years, all of them, not just China, but South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, all of them initially focused on low-skilled manufacturing, you know, building textiles factory, mm-hmm. clothing factories, you know, shoes, footwear, and so on. That was based on unskilled labor.
Yeah.
India chose to emphasize its high-skilled labor, and it was not so conscious as kind of almost by accident, because mm-hmm. you know, there was a neglect of basic education by the early leaders of the country. You know, there's a great book by Myron Weiner of MIT about the neglect of the child in India, and that's certainly true, that in the early years we didn't emphasize basic education, we emphasized higher education and skilled education, and then when the IT revolution came along,
all ready to go.
All ready to go. So that's mm-hmm. And then so it took off. Now, so there are two problems here. One, we could have dragged this IT thing, a revolution along for a little bit longer, had we generated even the doctors and the engineers and the software guys. We're not producing them in the quantities necessary even to generate this current model of development. And Anand alluded to that to some extent. You know, we need many more software engineers, many more call center guys, and so on. But India's education system, even the higher education system, is shambolic. You know, because you know the government regulates it very badly. The private sector isn't allowed to come in. So on the one hand, we can't continue doing that. On the other hand, many of our labor laws, the fact that infrastructure is so poor, militates against investment in manufacturing, and so we don't use our unskilled labor. So in a sense, we're stuck between two stools. You know, we do this skill-based model, can't generate the skills to sustain it, and we neglected our unskilled labor. And that's something we need to think more carefully about going forward.
Now, Anand, you raised this issue earlier about we have to beware of a neocolonial view, you know, white man's burden, what does India need to do? I think we may be at a moment where that's different, where white man, whatever that means today, the West, let's say, has had a good long scare from the BRICS, from Brazil and Russia, India, China, these rising economies that challenged, took so many jobs. People in the West wondered what was going to be left, but also saw them as rising real powers in a much more active two-way dialectic with the rest of the world. So that India's values matter to the United States and Europe suddenly, because India was rising as a power. It gives us a stake in the quality of India's cultural development, because it's going to be out there in the world. It's going to influence us. It's not all one way anymore, Anand.
Absolutely, and I agree with you. But the only corrective I would make to the way the West often approaches this is, you know, it's often way too growth-centric. We want India to grow at 8%, and people say that outright. India needs to open this or open that. I think what the West and others
should wish...
That's just
investment bankers talking. That's not everybody talking.
But the rest of us... I mean, the BRICS report was written by Goldman Sachs. That never gets mentioned. Yeah. That word was coined by an investment bank. And then we all just start using it like our mom taught it to us when we were growing up. There's an interest behind that word. And we have to remember what we should wish for these societies is that they become flourishing, good societies in which the maximum number of people get to kind of realize their dreams.
Amen.
And they need to figure that out for themselves to some degree. And it can be counterproductive to sit on the outside saying, you need to get back up to 8%, little kid, otherwise, you know, we're gonna withhold financing. Imagine if when the West was growing, there was some forerunner that was, you know, telling you, you need to elect Theodore Roosevelt right now and do some trust busting. It would have backfired. It would have been very counterproductive. These things are organic to a great degree.
I couldn't agree more, but there's another sense, which is not that kind of Wall Street perspective on India, and yet still cares about all these developments, because more than ever, we see we are in this together. The values that India champions ultimately are going to influence ours. Ours clearly can influence India's. Everybody's got a stake in this, it seems to me, the human values that grow around this. What an interesting hour. And I'm so grateful to the two of you for opening it up for us. Anand Giridharadas, author of India Calling, joined us from New York. And Anand, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Arvind Subramanian, wonderful economist, author of Eclipse, Living in the Shadow of China's Economic Dominance, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and at the Center for Global Development. Arvind, thank you so much for your insights today.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio, me at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Be the first to find out tomorrow's topics and guests by going to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit that like button. You'll get all the upcoming shows right there in your news feed. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.